From Europa to Mars, the search for life in our solar system. You're listening to Are We There Yet? The radio show exploring space exploration. Hi, I'm Brendan Byrne. A mission to Jupiter's moon Europa launched last month and has begun its years-long journey to the icy moon. Its goal? Scientists are hoping to discover evidence that might point to signs of life underneath the moon's icy surface. We'll speak with University of Washington in St. Louis's Paul Byrne about how life could be possible so far away from Earth and in a very, very cold ocean. Then, scientists are trying to find signs of life a bit closer to home. A new study proposes life could potentially exist in pools of water under the surface of Mars. We'll speak with University of Florida's Amy Williams about these Mars theories and updates from the rovers exploring the red planet. That's ahead on Are We There Yet? Last month, a spacecraft launched on a long-duration mission to a moon millions of miles away from Earth.
3, 2, 1, ignition, liftoff.
The mission is to Jupiter's moon Europa, and scientists want to know if the watery world beneath the icy crust could sustain life. But how could life thrive in temperatures so unlike our own planet? And how would a mission like Europa Clipper help us know? Well, here to answer that questions and talk about the science behind Europa Clipper is Paul Byrne, an associate professor of Earth, Environmental, and Planetary Sciences at Washington University in St. Louis. Paul, welcome back to the show.
Great to be here.
So decades of research and a handful of missions have provided quite strong evidence suggesting Europa may be one of the most promising places to sustain life. Let's first talk about the geological structure of this moon. What does it actually look like?
All right, so Europa, it's a fascinating place, and it looks quite different to stuff we might be more familiar with in the inner solar system. So first off, it's a little smaller than Earth's moon, and it's very bright. And the reason it's very bright is because the outer surface, the hard shell, is made of water ice. So it's a water-rich body, and because it's orbiting Jupiter, so it's quite far from the sun, it gets only a few percent of the sunlight that we do here on Earth, the outer liquid layer has frozen. So the outer shell is solid ice. But we think that underneath that solid ice is liquid water. And then underneath that liquid water, which could be several tens of miles deep, so it's essentially a subsurface liquid water ocean, there is a rocky body, which is, again, slightly smaller again. And so this is a fascinating world. It's a type of world we call an ocean world, or sometimes an icy satellite or icy moon. So we use those terms kind of interchangeably. But basically, Europa is a place that is a little bit like, it's like our moon insofar as it is rocky, it is kind of small, it's orbiting Jupiter. But imagine the moon with a few tens of miles of ocean on top of it, and the top layer of that ocean is now frozen. And that gives you an idea of what we're talking about for Europa.
So a crispy outer shell, soft middle, and then a crunchy center, if we're thinking about like Halloween candy, right?
honestly, there are a few geological concepts you cannot teach with food. That's a good way of thinking about it.
I'm looking at an image of Europa, and it's pretty fascinating. There's like these scars all across it. What are these kind of striations on the surface of it, or what appears to be the surface of it?
They are cracks, as far as we can tell. These are fractures in the ice shell, and many of them are kind of orangey. The shell itself is sort of whitish, and I say that it's water ice. It's probably not pure water ice. There's other stuff like ammonia mixed into it. But then you have these fractures, and there's thousands of them. I mean, there's generations of them. There's fractures that go one way, and then underneath them, you can see fractures going another way. And there is even this kind of weird sort of fracture we call a cycloid, which is looks like someone was doodling on the shell. Now, to be clear, we do not think anybody or anything doodled on the shell.
What a bummer.
I know, right? Probably not aliens, right? The thing is, there are these really interesting fractures. These fractures often look a little different in color to the rest of the shell. We think these fractures may actually be filled with an organic material that potentially has even been sourced from the ocean underneath. Now, we have pretty big and important questions about Europa. And one of the biggest questions is there a habitable environment inside this moon? And the reason we ask that question is the current thinking we have for life as we know it. But life as we know it requires, we think, water, some kind of organic chemistry, because we're made of organic compounds, and an energy source. And in the case of Europa, we strongly suspect the presence of this liquid water ocean. So that's the water box checked. And if there is potentially organic material inside the moon that may be, for example, making these fractures give the kind of characteristic orange color that they have, well, then maybe that's the second box, the organics check. And then that really just leaves the energy question. Is there some source of energy, is there some kind of engine that could be enabling chemical reactions to happen in the presence of water that might have in the past or even today led to life? And so that's one of the big questions that we have for Europa. And it's why there's so much focus on this moon. There really has been since we came to understand it properly way back when Voyagers 1 and 2 flew past Jupiter in the 1970s.
When you mention an energy source, what would that be? Like, what is that on Earth, and what would a comparison be on another celestial body?
Overwhelmingly, the way chemistry works, the way life chemistry works on Earth is using photosynthesis, right? It is why most of our vegetation is green. It's basically taking in sunlight and it's able to convert that into energy. The problem is that if you are underneath a thick carapace of ice and then at the bottom of a deep ocean, sunlight's not going to be something you can rely on. But we also know that there are environments on Earth that are not photosynthetic, they are chemosynthetic. They rely on chemistry. We know these environments exist, say, in the deep ocean. They occur in what we call hydrothermal vents. And so there are places on Earth where we know that life thrives in the absence of sunlight. So that's raising the question. And we came to really understand these environments in the 80s when we began to discover these things. And since then, we've learned a great deal about how many there are and how they work and the chemistry that's required to keep them going. But it raises the possibility that, you know, maybe just because these worlds are far away from the sun, they have an outer shell that prevents light getting to the interior. Maybe they don't need light in the same way that most life on Earth on the surface needs light. Maybe they need some kind of chemistry, and maybe that chemistry is happening deep inside Europa. You know, these are big unknown questions, and we're not necessarily going to get an answer to all of these questions with this new mission, Europa Clipper, but it's setting the stage for us to be able to get a better idea of what this moon is like, what its interior probably is. And then from there, we can begin to ask more serious questions like, could there be an environment deep inside this moon on, say, the ocean floor where the rock is in direct contact with water? Is there some energy source that may be akin to the kinds of hydrothermal systems we see deep in the ocean floors on Earth that potentially are supporting environments where there could be life?
Paul, what is really, really exciting about this mission to you?
First off, it's worth saying that although we know a fair amount about Europa, that information comes from missions that either flew past Jupiter or maybe orbited Jupiter, but flew past Europa. We've never had a dedicated mission that's focused just on Europa. And that's because it's hard to get a mission out there. It's expensive. The flight time is it's a long time. Now, Europa itself is also a very difficult place to study because it's deep inside Jupiter's very strong magnetic and radiation fields. And that means that Europa Clipper itself will not actually orbit Europa. If it did, it would only last a couple of months before that radiation fries all the electronics on board. And so what Europa Clipper is going to do is it's actually going to orbit Jupiter, but it's going to do several dozen flybys, very, very close flybys. In some instances, getting as within about 10 miles of the surface, where it's going to be able to swoop down low, take images of the surface, take geophysical measurements, take chemical measurements. There's a possibility that there are plumes coming out of Europa that could actually be that subsurface ocean coming out into space. We know there's a moon of Saturn called Enceladus where this is happening. And it may be that possibly this is happening in Europa, and Clipper will be able to detect those plumes and maybe even fly through them if they're there. But the idea is that by doing these successive swoops, Clipper is going to be able to return almost as much information as we would get if we were actually in orbit of Europa. But if we were in orbit, we'd only be there 2 or 3 months before the electronics die. Here, we'll have years where we're able to do these close approaches of Europa, but we won't be in that deep magnetic and radiation belt long enough for it to really damage the spacecraft. So hopefully Clipper will last quite a long time. And in doing that, it builds up this much more comprehensive picture than we currently have. It'll take high-resolution photos. It'll take all these different geophysical and geochemical measurements. It'll be able to measure magnetic fields in the area. It'll tell us if there is a liquid water ocean there. It'll place very good constraints on how thick that ocean is. It may be able to find evidence for plumes. It may be able to find evidence for active processes in the shell today. One of the big questions that it'll answer, we hope, is whether or not there's a possibility that there is water in the interior somehow able to make it up onto the top of the shell and thus be exposed to space, or even that material on the top of the shell could somehow find its way into the deep interior. Because if that happens, that's another way of introducing chemistry and energy into the ocean that potentially could be used by if there happen to be crawlies deep inside there. So Clipper is going to give us this. It's not going to answer all the questions. No one mission will ever do that. But after Clipper is finished, we will understand Europa truly as a world. Then we're ready to start answering the next set of questions. that may ultimately see us land on the surface or rove on the surface, or perhaps one day even get through the shell into the ocean beneath.
So while it not may find, as you call them, the crawlies under the surface, there's going to be some very consequential findings from this and very consequential answers in getting closer to figuring out if we are alone or if life exists outside of Earth, right? I mean, just how big of a mission is this for that grander question that planetary scientists always are trying to answer?
This is like the question, right? Are we alone? How did we get here? The more we discover information about the worlds around us in the solar system, the more we discover these extra solar planets, these planets orbiting other stars, we have yet to find a world quite like ours. Now, we've only been looking a little while, but we have some pretty basic questions. Why has there been life on this planet for almost all of its recorded history? These are pretty important questions, including, are there other places where you could find life? Europa is arguably the best place to look for to try and answer that question. And to your point, yeah, we're not probably going to find crawlies with this mission, but let's say we find information from Kuiper about Europa that tells us that Europa is a very promising habitable environment. Well, then that opens up not just Europa, but potentially other moons in our solar system and even bodies orbiting other stars. Or let's say we find out that for some reason or other, there really isn't a good chance of there being a habitable environment, much less life, inside Europa. That tells us something just as important. It might tell us that perhaps you need a large rocky planet like Earth for there to be an environment that can remain habitable and sustain life over geological time. I mean, these are basic questions that we really don't know the answer to.
Paul, at the start of our conversation, you mentioned the geology of Europa and describing it as an ocean world. Obviously, those are the reasons why we are excited to get there and make these observations. But is an ocean world like Enceladus common in our solar system, or is this kind of a rare place for us to be visiting?
You know, this is something that I don't know we have a good answer to yet, but the last few years in particular has been a renaissance of understanding the idea that liquid water is actually probably really common in the solar system. And in fact, although Europa is a little bit smaller than our moon, it has more liquid water than all of our oceans combined several times over. It may be that there are other places. There's another moon also orbiting Jupiter called Ganymede. In fact, Ganymede is bigger than Mercury. It may have a liquid water ocean. It actually gets kind of complicated because some of these moons are so big that the water actually gets compressed. And at the bottom of the ocean, the water may actually be ice, but it's not ice because it's cold. It's solid because it's being compressed. And that ice conceivably could be warm. So if you can imagine ice, it's a 60, 70 degrees Fahrenheit. I mean, that can be ice, right? This stuff doesn't exist on Earth, could exist in these moons. But there could be potentially a few dozen bodies in the solar system where they have these big, deep subsurface water oceans that are much greater in volume than any of the oceans you see on Earth. But it is, honestly, it looks like liquid water is probably not a rare commodity. I mean, okay, on Earth, fresh water, it's a different conversation, right? But in terms of solar system stuff, yeah, there could be dozens of these bodies in this and potentially other planetary systems too, where liquid water oceans underneath an ice shell are actually common.
Fascinating. Finally, Paul, these are all really, really exciting aspects of this mission, but we have to wait quite a bit of time before we're going to get any of this data back, right? When will we start learning more about Europa once Kuiper gets there?
Right. So late this decade is when Kuiper is going to get there, but it's going to take a while. So it takes a long time to get to Jupiter because we don't ever go anywhere in a straight line. That's not how we use orbital dynamics. So basically, it's a little bit like if you're trying to throw a football to someone in the end zone, the other end of the field, you have to sort of anticipate where they'll be by the time the ball gets there. So that's basically how we navigate in deep space. So Kuiper is going to make this kind of fairly complicated pattern. It's actually going to come back to Earth before it gets a gravity assist to go out and catch Jupiter. So it takes about 5.5 years to get there. But it's going to get there late this decade. And then it's going to take a while for it to enter into Jupiter orbit first, and then for it to basically be able to configure itself to start doing these close flybys. But, you know, the idea of flying a mission to Europa and trying to answer these questions goes back 20, 30 years. Us planetary scientists have to be a patient lot. You know, we'll be watching the spacecraft as it's flying so far. It looks like it's healthy. It'll make its way out of Jupiter slowly. It'll basically be climbing uphill as it's going away from the sun, ultimately to reach orbit into Jupiter and then to fly by around Europa. In the next 6 years, we will start to get these data back, and they will come down like a fire hose once they do. And very quickly, we will start to make some profound discoveries. It'll be worth the wait. Hang in there a little longer.
I will try to practice patience like a good planetary scientist, Paul, and I will wait. Speaking with Paul Byrne, Associate Professor of Earth, Environmental and Planetary Sciences at Washington University in St. Louis. Paul, always a pleasure to have you on.
My pleasure, brother. Thank you. Good to talk with you.
Still to come, life on Mars, googly eye eclipses.
We have a certain concept of what an eclipse should look like, right? A partial eclipse versus a full eclipse. But when you think about the very relatively small moons that orbit Mars, you don't get the same kind of coverage that you do with our moon from Earth. And so, yeah, you get an eclipse, but it is basically, you know, one of these irregularly shaped moons.
That's ahead on Are We There Yet? You're listening to Are We There Yet? I'm Brendan Byrne. We're now turning our attention to Mars, where scientists are on the hunt for signs of ancient life. As we continue to probe and rove the surface, more evidence suggests life could exist on the rocky surface. A new research study from NASA scientists suggests that there is a possibility microbes could find a home in pools of water underneath the surface. Our producer Marion Summerall spoke with Amy Williams, an astrobiologist at the University of Florida and a member of NASA's Mars science team, about that possible life on Mars and an update from the rovers exploring the Red Planet. Here's part of that conversation now.
Amy, welcome back to the show.
Thanks so much for having me back.
Amy, we've been asking if there's life on Mars for decades now, but some new research shows that there could be life under the surface of Mars, right? We're talking about water.
Absolutely. So I would actually even adjust your statement to say not just looking for life on Mars for decades, but I would say really, you know, centuries, right? As soon as we realized Mars was another world, we've been kind of like looking at it and asking, could life be there? You know, like this is like what Schia Parelli's Canale were like on Mars, right? Wondering if there's a civilization there. So, I mean, it's truly a question that just sticks with us. So what have NASA Mars scientists been up to recently? There is a paper that came out recently that talks about whether you could have life in the subsurface of Mars, but in very specific locations. And this is like a really cool study because the work is done in modeling and the foundation is based on observations that we've made on Mars with regards to water ice. So if folks have listened to me rant and rave about Mars on the show before, they might remember that the things that we're looking for life on Mars is more related to life as we know it. So we're looking for evidence for liquid water, carbon, and a source of kind of metabolic energy for life. And so this whole story is based around the presence of that liquid water. And so what the study was describing is they've modeled that you could have a water ice, which we know exists on Mars. You can actually have little pools of water. And we're not talking about like a swimming pool size thing. We're talking about little pockets that are like probably, you know, maybe an inch in diameter, something like that. But these little pockets of water that can form underneath the ice. So it's sort of like a liquid bubble instead of an air bubble in the ice. The modeling that they did demonstrated that you actually could get this, you know, feet into the ice, and it would provide enough protection from things like the radiation environment on Mars to protect the things that are in that little pool of water, while also being shallow enough that if there were organisms in there, and if they could use light energy the way that plants and bacteria do on Earth via photosynthesis, those organisms would actually receive enough of an energy flux to perform photosynthesis as we understand it on Earth. So it's a really cool thing to model and to discover, like, there is enough energy flux for photosynthesis actually at depth. You don't have to be on the surface if you're in water ice, you know, but it's also, of course, making many assumptions like that there is or was life on Mars, which you all know I think about a lot. And then, you know, whether it developed photosynthetic capabilities and if it happens to be present in these little kind of remnant water ice regions on Mars. So a lot of assumptions, but it's really cool to kind of see like how far can we push what we think life can do, at least life as we know it. How far can we push that to make interpretations about where to look for life?
So I want to make sure I have this right. So these small pools of water are kind of pockets in the ice. Has this water potentially survived since, you know, we have evidence of water that used to flow freely on Mars? Where did this water come from and how could it even be there?
That's one of the, you know, million-dollar questions. So, you know, there's a discussion about, so like the way that the sort of terrestrial model that's used for this work is describing how you would have like snow that would precipitate out and it would eventually kind of condense into ice. And it's that kind of model on Earth where you find sort of these little pockets of water that can form under the ice. And so using a similar model, you would think that perhaps that's what you would need. I would imagine you don't necessarily have to have snow have formed this and it be, you know, billions or even millions of years old. This may be some of just that residual water ice. Obviously, water has been very slowly cycling on Mars, even with its really limited hydrologic cycle. It does still exist, just not normally in a liquid water form. It's normally in ice or it's in water vapor. So is it the same water from ancient times generally been cycled through in the same way that our oceans are the water on our Earth that's been on our Earth for billions of years as well? But it's probably undergone some type of cycling. So, you know, what you're looking at is maybe if something is blown in with the wind and settled into the ice and sort of become entrained in it.
I want to pivot this conversation and check in on our favorite robot friends on Mars. What is going on with Curiosity and Perseverance?
So it's so funny because, you know, to me, I'm like, yeah, we're just rolling along on Mars. But then I have to stop and say, like, yeah, we're roving on Mars. It's still incredible. You know, it's really more than a decade later for Curiosity. And I still have to remind myself, like, think about how profound that is to be able to say that we sent robots to another world and they're operating and they have been for more than a decade. It's so cool. So what are they up to? We're always collecting data with both of the missions. Curiosity is still exploring sort of this upper range of a place called Geddes Vallis and the sulfate bearing unit in Gale Crater. We roll a little bit slower these days than we used to, going up steep slopes and just being careful of how our wheels are wearing. And, you know, it's sort of like the human story. As you get older, you maybe move a little bit slower. But we are climbing Gale Crater, continue to do so, and exploring sort of this really interesting exposure of rocks that indicate that Mars underwent this, you know, massive drying, I don't even want to say event. It's really like sort of the drying out of Mars is likely what we're seeing here. And so, yeah, just slowly trundling along and collecting kind of contact science on our way up as we're trying to understand a little more about the details of what these rocks are made of and how they formed. And then regards to Perseverance, you want to talk about steep slopes. We've been climbing out of Jezero Crater. We're on the crater rim. And it's so incredible to like kind of look back at our images and look at our rover tracks and how like steep the slope is that we're actually climbing. And so we have to be kind of, you know, careful, like just like you would slip down a slope if you're climbing up in the mountains, you know, we just have to be very careful about how we drive. And if you get into sand, you need to be careful. You can't slip. So, yeah, all the things that you would worry about being, you know, sort of an outdoorsy person on Earth are things that our rovers are contending with on Mars. But Perseverance is climbing up the inner crater rim. We're exploring the nature of the rocks there, what they can tell us about sort of the impact that made Jezero billions of years ago, as well as sort of the rocks outside of Jezero Crater. So this is really ancient Noachian basements. That's kind of the one of the earliest periods on Mars when there was water on Mars. And so we're kind of getting into this threshold where we're starting to explore sort of a very different era on Mars than we've explored before with this rover.
Aside from the possibility of life on Mars and exploring craters, Perseverance has also captured a really cool image recently, a googly eye eclipse. Tell me a little bit about this image and the solar eclipse.
Oh, well, so if you think about kind of where Earth and our moon are relative to our sun. You think about the relative size of our moon to our sun. You know, we have a certain concept of what an eclipse should look like, right? A partial eclipse versus a full eclipse. But when you think about the very relatively small moons that orbit Mars, you don't get the same kind of coverage that you do with our moon from Earth. And so, yeah, you get an eclipse, but it is basically, you know, one of these irregularly shaped moons covering a portion of the sun. So it's a really cool way, I think, for me to kind of step back and be like, if I were a Martian, that is what an eclipse would be to me. And you would probably feel the same way that maybe ancient persons felt when there was an eclipse and they didn't know it was going to happen. They couldn't predict it. And they would think, all right, something seriously wrong is happening. it shouldn't be dark like this, right? Like someone who's never experienced that before might think that there's something very, very different from what I'm normally used to. And so, yeah, a Martian might think the same thing seeing a terrestrial eclipse. But yeah, it's just another really, I think, great way to consider how our terrestrial experience is unique in so many ways. We are on any other planet, our experience would be quite different.
And lastly, Amy, what's next in the Mars world? What can we look forward to?
Like I said, we're still climbing kind of two mountains or ridges right now with the two existing rover missions. Always keep your eyes peeled because, you know, we're not only are we collecting new data, but there's such a backlog of existing data. It's all, you know, publicly available. And so our scientists are actually going back through older data and exploring, you know, like what can we say about this or that data set that we really haven't had time to dig into before. There's so much data. There's so little time. There are lifetimes of research to complete on all of the information we've returned from just these two rovers. So we keep your eyes peeled for, you know, as we continue exploring outside of Jezero with Perseverance, I think we're getting into a really unique landscape and geology that we just haven't really explored before. And I think it'll give us a lot of insight into both, you know, the samples we want to collect from our sample return and maybe where future missions would want to explore as well.
Amy Williams is a member of NASA's Mars Science Team and an astrobiologist at the University of Florida. Amy, thank you so much for coming back on the show to talk about all things Mars.
Of course, anytime.
Turning gears once again, it's Election Day here in the U.S., and many people have already voted before Election Day by mail-in ballots. Well, that voting preference has been extended to people off this planet. NASA said the four U.S. astronauts currently aboard the International Space Station intended to cast their absentee ballots from orbit. Voting off-planet has occurred for more than two decades, just a little more complicated than a mail-in ballot. Digital ballots are securely sent to and from the station and then to supervisors of elections back here on Earth. We spoke with veteran NASA astronaut Nicole Stott, who voted from space in 2009. She said it was an easy process.
Worked great. We tried to give ourselves the same experience we might have if we were going into the polls at home. And so we set up two floating voting stations with like a little screen in between us and our computers on their stands and labeled them, you know, port and starboard voting booth.
The one thing missing? One of those I voted stickers. We'll post our story from the last presidential election in 2020 about the history of voting from orbit. Check our website, cfpublic.org/arewetherayet. That's going to do it for this week's show. If you're not already, be sure to subscribe to the show's podcast feed so you never miss an episode. You can do that on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, YouTube, or wherever you get your podcasts. Stay connected with the show. Be sure to follow us on social media. You can find us on Instagram and Facebook or at AWTYSpace. And if you've got an idea for a future episode of the show or you want to join us as a guest, reach out. We're at arewetherayet@cfpublic.org. For space coverage online, visit cfpublic.org/space. Are We There Yet is a production of Central Florida Public Media. Our producer is Marion Summerall. Our intern is Jenna Weiss. Editorial guidance from Latoya Dennis. Support for Are We There Yet comes from our listeners. Until next week, I'm Brendan Byrne. Thanks for listening.